"I'm glad," she said. "You've needed something for a long time now. I don't think you even know it, but you have. I've got the Relief Committee and the Commission on Women's Rights and the Theatre Society, but you've needed something, some people, to grow old with, I think." I went to the bed and sat beside her and picked up the long goodbye. It was a bright, new minted paperback. I could remember buying the original hardback edition as a birthday present for Ellen in 1953. "Are we old?" I asked her. "I suspect we are," she said, and smiled brilliantly at me. I put the book down and touched her breast. "Too old for this?" She turned the covers back with ladylike decorum, and then, giggling, kicked them onto the floor with her feet. "Beat me, Daddy," Ellen said. "8 to the bar." "Oink, oink," I said, and then we were both laughing. The Thursday before Christmas came. That evening was much the same as the others, with two notable exceptions. There were more people there, perhaps as many as 18, and there was a sharp, indefinable sense of excitement in the air. Johansson took only a cursory glance at his journal and then joined McCarran, Hugh Beagleman, and myself. We sat near the windows talking of this and that, then finally fell into a passionate and often hilarious discussion of pre-war automobiles. There was, now that I think of it, a third difference as well. Stevens had concocted a delicious eggnog punch. It was smooth, but it was also hot, with rum and spices. It was served from an incredible Waterford bowl that looked like an ice sculpture, and the animated hum of the conversation grew ever higher as the level of the punch grew lower. I looked over in the corner by the tiny door leading to the billiard room and was astounded to see Waterhouse and Norman Stett flipping baseball cards into what looked like a genuine beaver top hat. They were laughing uproariously. Groups formed and reformed. The hour grew late. And then, at the time when people usually began slipping out through the front door, I saw Peter Andrews seated in front of the fire with an unmarked packet, about the size of a seed envelope, in one hand. He tossed it into the flames without opening it, and a moment later the fire began to dance with every color of the spectrum, and some I would have sworn from outside of it before turning yellow again. Chairs were dragged around. Over Andrew's shoulder I could see the keystone with its etched homily. "It is the tale, not he who tells it." Stevens passed unobtrusively among us, taking punch glasses and replacing them with snifters of brandy. There were murmurs of "Merry Christmas" and "Top of the season, Stevens," and for the first time I saw money change hands. A $10 bill was unobtrusively tendered here, a bill that looked like a 50 there, one which I clearly saw was 100 from another chair. "Thank you, Mr. McCarran." "Mr. Johansson, Mr. Beagleman," a quiet, well-bred murmur. I have lived in New York long enough to know that the Christmas season is a carnival of tips, something for the butcher, the baker, the candlestick maker, not to mention the doorman, the super, and the cleaning lady who comes in Tuesdays and Fridays. I've never met anyone of my own class who regarded this as anything but a necessary nuisance. But I felt none of that grudging spirit on that night. The money was given willingly, even eagerly, and suddenly, for no reason. It was the way thoughts often seemed to come when one was at 249B. I thought of the boy calling up to Scrooge on the still cold air of a London Christmas morning. "What? The goose that's as big as me?" And Scrooge, nearly crazed with joy, giggling, "A good boy, an excellent boy." I found my own wallet. In the back of this, behind the pictures of Ellen I keep, there has always been a $50 bill which I keep for emergencies. When Stevens gave me my brandy, I slipped it into his hand with never a qualm, although I was not a rich man. "Happy Christmas, Stevens," I said. "Thank you, sir, and the same to you." He finished passing out the brandies and collecting his honorariums and retired. I glanced around once at the midpoint of Peter Andrews' story and saw him standing by the double doors, a dim, man-like shadow, stiff and silent. I'm a lawyer now, as most of you know, Andrews said, after sipping at his glass, clearing his throat, and then sipping again. I've had offices on Park Avenue for the last 22 years, but before that I was a legal assistant in a firm of lawyers which did business in Washington, D.C. One night in July I was required to stay late in order to finish indexing case citations in a brief which hasn't anything at all to do with this story. But then a man came in, a man who was at that time one of the most widely known senators on the Hill, a man who later almost became president. His shirt was matted with blood, and his eyes were bulging from their sockets. "I've got to talk to Joe," he said. Joe, you understand, was Joseph Woods, the head of my firm, one of the most influential private sector lawyers in Washington, and this senator's close personal friend. "He went home hours ago," I said. "I was terribly frightened, I can tell you. He looked like a man who had just walked away from a dreadful car accident, or perhaps from a knife fight. And somehow seeing his face, which I had seen in newspaper photos and on Meet the Press, seeing it streaked with gore, one cheek twitching spasmodically below one wild eye, all of that made my fright worse. I can call him if you—" I was already fumbling with the phone, mad with eagerness to turn this unexpected responsibility over to someone else. Looking behind him, I could see the caked and bloody footprints he had left on the carpet. "I've got to talk to Joe right now," he reiterated, as if he hadn't heard me. "There's something in the trunk of my car, something I found out at the Virginia place. I've shot it and stabbed it, and I can't kill it. It's not human, and I can't kill it." He began to giggle, and then to laugh, and finally to scream, and he was still screaming when I finally got Mr. Woods on the phone and told him to come, for God's sake, to come as fast as he could. It is not my purpose to tell Peter Andrews' story, either. As a matter of fact, I'm not sure I would dare to tell it. Suffice it to say that it was a tale so gruesome that I dreamed of it for weeks afterward, and Ellen once looked at me over the breakfast table and asked me why I had suddenly cried out, his head is still speaking in the earth," in the middle of the night. "I suppose it was a dream," I said, "one of those you can't remember afterwards." But my eyes dropped immediately to my coffee cup, and I think that Ellen knew the lie that time. One day in August of the following year, I was buzzed as I worked in the reading library. It was George Waterhouse. He asked me if I could step up to his office. When I got there, I saw that Robert Carden was also there and Henry Effingham. For one moment, I was positive I was about to be accused of some really dreadful act of stupidity or ineptitude. Then Carden stepped around to me and said, "George believes that time has come to make you a junior partner, David. The rest of us agree." "It's going to be a little bit like being the world's oldest J.C.," Effingham said with a grin. "But it's the channel you have to go through, David. With any luck, we can make you a full partner by Christmas." There were no bad dreams that night. Ellen and I went out to dinner, drank too much, went on to a jazz place, where we hadn't been in nearly 6 years, and listened to that amazing blue-eyed black man Dexter Gordon blow his horn until almost 2 in the morning. We woke up the next morning with fluttery stomachs and achy heads, both of us still unable to completely believe what had happened. One of them was that my salary had just climbed by $8,000 a year, long after our expectations of such a staggering income jump had fallen by the wayside. The firm sent me to Copenhagen for 6 weeks that fall, and I returned to discover that John Hanrahan, one of the regular attendees at 249B, had died of cancer. A collection was taken up for his wife, who had been left in unpleasant circumstances. I was pressed into service to total the amount, which was given entirely in cash, and convert it to a cashier's check. It came to more than $10,000. I turned the check over to Stevens, and I suppose he mailed it. It just so happened that Arlene Hanrahan was a member of Ellen's Theatre Society, and Ellen told me sometime later that Arlene had received an anonymous check for $10,400. Written on the check stub was the brief and unilluminating message, "Friends of your late husband John." "Isn't that the most amazing thing you ever heard in your life?" Ellen asked me. "No," I said. "But it's right up there in the top 10. Are there any more strawberries, Ellen?" The years went by. I discovered a warren of rooms upstairs at 249B. A writing room, a bedroom where guests sometimes stayed overnight, although after that slithery bump I had heard, or imagined I had heard, I believe I personally would rather have registered at a good hotel. A small but well-equipped gymnasium and a sauna bath. There was also a long, narrow room which ran the length of the building and contained two bowling alleys. In those same years I re-read the novels of Edward Gray Saville, and discovered an absolutely stunning poet, the equal of Ezra Pound and Wallace Stevens, perhaps, named Norbert Rosen. According to the back flap on one of the three volumes of his work in the stacks, he had been born in 1924 and killed at Anzio. All three volumes of his work had been published by Stedham and Son, New York and Boston. I remember going back to the New York Public Library on a bright spring afternoon during one of those years, of which year I am no longer sure, and requesting 20 years except for Tozman himself. Lathrop Carruthers, the American general who everyone had by then decided must be utterly insane, he had been responsible for better than 18,000 casualties by then, lives and limbs spent as casually as you or I might spend a quarter in a jukebox, was standing at a map of the front lines when the shell struck. He had been explaining yet another mad flanking operation at the moment, an operation which would have succeeded only on the level of all the others Carruthers had hatched. It would be wonderfully successful at making new widows. And when the dust cleared, Gerard Tozman, dazed and deaf, bleeding from his nose, his ears, and the corners of both eyes, his testicles already swelling from the force of the concussion, had come upon Carruthers' body while looking for a way out of the abattoir that had been the staff HQ only minutes before. He looked at the general's body and then began to scream and laugh. The sounds went unheard by his own shell-shocked ears, but they served to notify the medicos that someone was still alive in that strew of matchwood. Carruthers had not been mutilated by the blast, at least Tozman said. It hadn't been what the soldiers of that long-ago war had come to 49B, and I could not resist telling it. And then, on the Thursday after Thanksgiving of this year, when Stevens clapped his hands together for attention and asked who would favor us with a Christmas tale, Emlyn McCarran growled, "I suppose I've got something that bears telling. Tell it now or tell it never, God'll shut me up for good soon enough." In the years I had been coming to 249B, I had never heard McCarran tell a story, and perhaps that's why I called the taxi so early, and why, when Stevens passed out eggnog to the six of us who had ventured out on that bellowing, frigid night, I felt so keenly excited. Nor was I the only one. I saw that same excitement on a good many other faces. McCarran, old and dry and leathery, sat in the huge chair by the fire with the packet of powder in his gnarled hands. He tossed it in, and we watched the flame shift colors madly before returning to yellow again. Stevens passed among us with brandy, and we passed him his Christmas honorarium. Once, during that yearly ceremony, I had heard the clink of change passing from the hand of the giver to the hand of the receiver. On another occasion, I had seen a $1,000 bill for a moment in the firelight. On both occasions, the murmur of Stevens's voice had been exactly the same, low, considerate, and entirely correct. 10 years, more or less, had passed since I had first come to 249B with George Waterhouse, and while much had changed in the world outside, nothing had changed in here, and Stevens seemed not to have aged a month or even a single day. He moved back into the shadows, and for a moment there was a silence so perfect that we could hear the faint whistle of boiling sap escaping from the burning logs on the hearth. Emlyn McCarran was looking into the fire, and we all followed his gaze. The flames seemed particularly wild that night. I felt almost hypnotized by the sight of the fire, as I suppose the cavemen who birthed us were once hypnotized by it, as the wind walked and talked outside their cold northern caves. At last, still looking into the fire, bent slightly forward so that his forearms rested on his thighs and his clasped hands hung in a knot between his knees, McCarran began to speak. 2. The breathing method. I am nearly 80 now, which means that I was born with the century. All my life I have been associated with a building which stands almost directly across from Madison Square Garden. This building, which looks like a great gray prison, something out of A Tale of Two Cities, is actually a hospital, as most of you know. It is Harriet White Memorial Hospital. The Harriet White after whom it was named was my father's first wife, and she got her practical experience in nursing when there were still actual sheep grazing on Sheep Meadow in Central Park. A statue of the lady herself stands on a pedestal in the courtyard before the building, and if any of you have seen it, you may have wondered how a woman with such a stern and uncompromising face could have found such a gentle occupation. The motto chiseled into the statue's base once you get rid of the Latin folderol is even less comforting. There is no comfort without pain. Thus we define salvation through suffering. Cato, if you please. Or if you don't please. I was born inside that gray stone building on March 20th, 1900. I returned there as an intern in the year 1926. 26 is old to be just starting out in the world of medicine, but I had done a more practical internship in France at the end of World War I, trying to pack ruptured guts back into stomachs that had been blown wide open, and dealing on the black market for morphine, which was often tinctured and sometimes dangerous. As with the generation of physicians following World War II, we were a bedrock practical out of Sawbones. And the records of the major medical school show a remarkably small number of washouts in the years 1919 to 1928. We were older, more experienced, steadier. Were we also wiser? I don't know. But we were certainly more cynical. There was none of this nonsense you read about in the popular medical novels, stuff about fainting or vomiting at one's first autopsy, not after Bellow Wood, where mama rats sometimes raised whole litters of ratlings in the gas-exploded intestines of the soldiers left to rot in no man's land. We had gotten all our puking and passing out behind us. The Harriet White Memorial Hospital also figured largely in something that happened to me 9 years after I had interned there. And this is the story I want to tell you, gentlemen, tonight. It is not a tale to be told at Christmas, you would say, although its final scene was played out on Christmas Eve, and yet while it is certainly horrible, it also seems to express to me all the amazing power of our cursed, doomed species. In it I see the wonder of our will, and also its horrible, tenebrous power. Birth itself, gentlemen, is a horrid thing to many. It is the fashion now that fathers should be present at the birth of their children. And while this fashion has served to inflict many men with a guilt which I feel they may not deserve, it is a guilt which some women use knowingly and with an almost prescient cruelty. It seems by and large to be a healthful, salubrious thing. Yet I have seen men leave the delivery room white and tottering, and I have seen them swoon like girls overcome by the cries and the blood. I remember one father who held up just fine, only to begin screaming hysterically as his perfectly healthy son pushed its way into the world. The infant's eyes were open. It gave the impression of looking around, and then its eyes settled on the father. Birth is wonderful, gentlemen, but I have never found it beautiful, not by any stretch of the imagination. I believe it is too brutal to be beautiful. A woman's womb is like an engine. With conception, that engine is turned on. At first it barely idles. But as the creative cycle nears the climax of birth, that engine revs up and up and up. Its idling whisper becomes a steady running hum, and then a rumble, and finally a bellowing, frightening roar. Once that engine has been turned on, every mother-to-be understands that her life is in check. Either she will bring the baby forth and the engine will shut down again, or that engine will pound louder and harder and faster until it explodes, killing her in blood and pain. This is a story of birth, gentlemen. On the eve of that birth we have celebrated for almost 2,000 years. I began practicing medicine in 1929, a bad year to begin anything. My grandfather was able to lend me a small sum of money, so I was luckier than many of my colleagues. But I still had to survive over the next 4 years, mostly on my wits. By 1935, things had improved a bit. I had developed a bedrock of steady patients and was getting quite a few outpatient referrals from White Memorial. In April of that year, I saw a new patient, a young woman, whom I will call Sandra Stansfield. That name is close enough to what her name really was. This was a young woman, white, who stated her age to be 28. After examining her, I guessed her true age to be between 3 and 5 years younger than that. She was blonde, slender, and tall for that time, about 5 feet 8 inches. She was quite beautiful, but in an austere way that was almost forbidding. Her features were clear and regular, her eyes intelligent, and her mouth every bit as determined as the stone mouth of Harriet White on the statue across from Madison Square Garden. The name she put on her form was not Sandra Stansfield, but Jane Smith. My examination subsequently showed her to be about 2 months gone in pregnancy. She wore no wedding ring. After the preliminary exam, but before the results of the pregnancy test were in, my nurse, Ella Davidson, said, "That girl yesterday, Jane Smith, if that isn't an assumed name, I never heard one." I agreed. Still, I rather admired her. She had not engaged in the usual shilly-shallying, toe-scuffing, blushing, tearful behavior. She had been straightforward and businesslike. Even her alias had seemed more a matter of business than of shame. There had been no attempt to provide verisimilitude by creating a Betty Ruckelhouse or wamping up a Ternina DeVille. "You require a name for the form," she seemed to be saying, "because that is the law, so here is a name. But rather than trusting to the professional ethics of a man I don't know, I'll trust in myself, if you don't mind." Ella sniffed and passed a few remarks, modern girls and bold as brass. But she was a good woman, and I don't think she said those things, except for the sake of form. She knew as well as I did that whatever my new patient might be, she was no little trollop with hard eyes and round heels. No, Jane Smith was merely an extremely serious, extremely determined young woman. If either of those things can be described by such a milquetoast adverb as merely, it was an unpleasant situation. It used to be called getting in a scrape, as you gentlemen may remember. Nowadays it seems that many young women use a scrape to get out of the scrape. And she meant to go through it with whatever grace and dignity she could manage. A week after her initial appointment, she came in again. That was a peach of a day, one of the first real days of spring. The air was mild, the sky a soft, milky shade of blue, and there was a smell on the breeze, a warm, indefinable smell that seems to be nature's signal that she is entering her own birth cycle again. The sort of day one wished to be miles from any responsibility, sitting opposite a lovely woman of one's own, at Coney Island, maybe, or on the Palisades across the Hudson, with a picnic hamper on a checkered cloth, and the lady in question wearing a great white cartwheel hat and a sleeveless gown as pretty as the day. Jane Smith's dress had sleeves, but it was still almost as pretty as the day. A smart white linen with brown edging. She wore brown pumps, white gloves, and a cloche hat that was slightly out of fashion. It was the first sign I saw that she was a far-from-rich woman. "You're pregnant," I said. "I don't believe you doubted it much, did you?" "If there are to be tears," I thought, "they will come now." "No," she said with perfect composure. There was no more a sign of tears in her eyes than there were rain clouds on the horizon that day. I'm very regular, as a rule. There was a pause between us. "When may I expect to deliver?" she asked then, with an almost soundless sigh. It was the sound a man or woman might make before bending over to pick up a heavy load. "It will be a Christmas baby," I said. "December 10th is the date I'll give you, but it could be 2 weeks on either side of that." "All right." She hesitated briefly, then plunged ahead. "Will you attend me, even though I'm not married?" "Yes," I said, "on one condition." She frowned, and in that moment her face was more like the face of Harriet White than ever. One would not think that the frown of a woman perhaps only 23 could be particularly formidable, but this one was. She was ready to leave, and the fact that she would have to go through this entire embarrassing process again with another doctor was not going to deter her. "And what might that be?" she asked, with perfect colorless courtesy. Now it was I who felt an urge to drop my eyes from her steady hazel ones, but I held her gaze. "I insist upon knowing your real name. We can continue to do business on a cash basis, if that is how you prefer it, and I can continue to have Mrs. Davidson issue you receipts in the name of Jane Smith. But if we are going to travel through the next 7 months or so together, I would like to be able to address you by the name to which you answer in all the rest of your life." I finished this absurdly stiff little speech and watched her think it through. I was somehow quite sure she was going to stand up, thank me for my time, and leave forever. I was going to feel disappointed if that happened. I liked her. Even more, I liked the straightforward way she was handling a problem which would have reduced 90 women out of 100 to inept and undignified liars, terrified by the living clock within, and so deeply ashamed of their situation that to make any reasonable plan for coping with it became impossible. I suppose many young people today would find such a state of mind ludicrous, ugly, even hard to believe. People have become so eager to demonstrate their broad-mindedness that a pregnant woman who has no wedding ring is apt to be treated with twice the solicitude of one who does. You gentlemen will well remember when the situation was quite different. You will remember a time when rectitude and hypocrisy were combined to make a situation that was viciously difficult for a woman who had gotten herself in a scrape. In those days, a married, pregnant woman was a radiant woman, sure of her position, and proud of fulfilling what she considered to be the function God put her on earth for. An unmarried, pregnant woman was a trollop in the eyes of the world, and apt to be a trollop in her own eyes as well. They were, to use Ella Davidson's word, easy. And in that world and that time, easiness was not quickly forgiven. Such women crept away to have their babies in other towns or cities. Some took pills or jumped from buildings. Others went to butcher abortionists with dirty hands or tried to do the job themselves. In my time as a physician, I have seen 4 women die of blood loss before my eyes as the result of punctured wounds. In one case, the puncturing was done by the jagged neck of a Dr. Pepper bottle that had been tied to the handle of a whisk broom. It is hard to believe now that such things happened, but they did, gentlemen, they did. It was, quite simply, the worst situation a healthy young woman could find herself in. "All right," she said at last, "that's fair enough. My name is Sandra Stansfield." And she held her hand out. Rather amazed, I took it and shook it. I'm rather glad Ella Davidson didn't see me do that. She would have made no comment, but the coffee would have been bitter for the next week. She smiled, at my own expression of bemusement, I imagine, and looked at me frankly. "I hope we can be friends, Dr. McCarran. I need a friend just now. I'm quite frightened." "I can understand that, and I'll try to be your friend if I can, Miss Stansfield. Is there anything I can do for you now?" She opened her handbag and took out a dime store pad and a pen. She opened the pad, poised the pen, and looked up at me. For one horrified instant, I believed she was going to ask me for the name and address of an abortionist. Then she said, "I'd like to know the best things to eat. For the baby, I mean." I laughed out loud. She looked at me with some amazement. "Forgive me, it's just that you seem so businesslike." "I suppose," she said, "this baby is a part of my business now, isn't it, Dr. McCarran?" "Yes. Of course it is. And I have a folder which I give to all my pregnant patients. It deals with diet and weight and drinking and smoking and lots of other things. Please don't laugh when you look at it. You'll hurt my feelings if you do, because I wrote it myself. And so I had, although it was really more of a pamphlet than a folder, and in time became my book, A Practical Guide to Pregnancy and Delivery. I was quite interested in obstetrics and gynecology in those days, still am, although it was not a thing to specialize in back then, unless you had plenty of uptown connections. Even if you did, it might take 10 or 15 years to establish a strong practice. Having hung out my shingle at a rather too ripe age as a result of the war, I didn't feel I had the time to spare. I contented myself with the knowledge that I would see a great many happy, expectant mothers and deliver a great many babies in the course of my general practice. And so I did. At last count, I had delivered well over 2,000 babies, enough to fill 50 classrooms. I kept up with the literature on having babies more smartly than I did on that applying to any other area of general practice. And because my opinions were strong, enthusiastic ones, I wrote my own pamphlet rather than just passing along the stale chestnuts so often foisted on young mothers then. I won't run through the whole catalog of these chestnuts. We'd be here all night, but I'll mention a couple. Expectant mothers were urged to stay off their feet as much as possible, and on no account were they to walk any sustained distance lest a miscarriage or birth damage result. Now, giving birth is an extremely strenuous piece of work, and such advice is like telling a football player to prepare for the big game by sitting him round as much as possible so he won't tire himself out. Another sterling piece of advice, given by a good many doctors, was that moderately overweight mothers-to-be take up smoking. Smoking! The rationale was perfectly expressed by an advertising slogan of the day, "Have a lucky instead of a sweet." People who have the idea that when we entered the 20th century we also entered an age of medical light and reason have no idea of how utterly crazy medicine could sometimes be. Perhaps it's just as well their hair would turn white. I gave Miss Stansfield my folder, and she looked through it with complete attention for perhaps 5 minutes. I asked her permission to smoke my pipe, and she gave it absently without looking up. When she did look up at last, there was a small smile on her lips. "Are you a radical, Dr. McCarran?" she asked. "Why do you say that?" "Because I advise that the expectant mother should walk her round of errands instead of riding in a smoky, jolting subway car. Prenatal vitamins, whatever they are, swimming recommended, and breathing exercises." "What breathing exercises?" "That comes later on. And no, I'm not a radical. Far from it. What I am is 5 minutes overdue on my next patient." "Oh, I'm sorry." She got to her feet quickly, tucking the thick folder into her purse. "No need." She shrugged into her light coat, looking at me with those direct hazel eyes as she did so. "No," she said, "not a radical at all. I suspect you're actually quite comfortable. Is that the word I want?" "I hope it will serve," I said. "It's a word I like. If you speak to Mrs. Davidson, she'll give you an appointment schedule. I'll want to see you again early next month." "Your Mrs. Davidson doesn't approve of me." "Oh, I'm sure that's not true at all. But I've never been a particularly good liar, and the warmth between us suddenly slipped away. I did not accompany her to the door of my consulting room. "Miss Stansfield?" She turned toward me, coolly inquiring, "Do you intend to keep the baby?" She considered me briefly and then smiled, a secret smile, which I am convinced only pregnant women know. "Oh, yes," she said, and let herself out. By the end of that day, I had treated identical twins for identical cases of poison ivy, lanced a boil, removed a hook of metal from a sheet welder's eye, and referred one of my oldest patients to White Memorial for what was surely cancer. I had forgotten all about Sandra Stansfield by then. Ella Davidson recalled her to my mind by saying, "Perhaps she's not a chippy after all." I looked up from my last patient's folder. I had been looking at it, feeling that useless disgust most doctors feel when they know they have been rendered completely helpless, and thinking I ought to have a rubber stamp made up for such files, only instead of saying account receivable or paid in full or patient moved, it would simply say death warrant, perhaps with a skull and crossbones above like those on bottles of poison. "Pardon me? You're Miss Jane Smith. She did a most peculiar thing after her appointment this morning. The set of Mrs. Davidson's head and mouth made it clear that this was the sort of peculiar thing of which she approved. And what was that? When I gave her her appointment card, she asked me to tout up her expenses, all of her expenses, delivery and hospital stay included. That was a peculiar thing, all right. This was 1935, remember, and Miss Stansfield gave every impression of being a woman on her own. Was she well off, even comfortably off? I didn't think so. Her dress, shoes, and gloves had all been smart, but she had worn no jewelry, not even costume jewelry. And then there was her hat, that decidedly out-of-date cloche. Did you do it? I asked. Mrs. Davidson looked at me as though I might have lost my senses. Did I? Of course I did, and she paid the entire amount in cash. The last, which apparently had surprised Mrs. Davidson the most, in an extremely pleasant way, of course, surprised me not at all. One thing which the Jane Smiths of the world can't do is write checks. Took a bank book out of her purse, opened it, and counted the money right out onto my desk, Mrs. Davidson was continuing. Then she put her receipt in where the cash had been, put the bank book into her purse again, and said good day. Not half bad when you think of the way we've had to chase some of these so-called respectable people to make them pay their bills. I felt chagrined for some reason. I was not happy with the Stansfield woman for having done such a thing, with Mrs. Davidson for being so pleased and complacent with the arrangement, and with myself for some reason I couldn't define then and can't now. Something about it made me feel small. But she couldn't very well pay for a hospital stay now, could she? I asked. It was a ridiculously small thing to seize on, but it was all I could find at that moment on which to express my pique and half-amused frustration. After all, none of us knows how long she'll have to remain there. Or are you reading the crystal now, Ella? I told her that very thing, and she asked what the average stay was following an uncomplicated birth. I told her 6 days. Wasn't that right, Dr. McCarran? I had to admit it was. She said that she would pay for 6 days then, and if it was longer, she would pay the difference. And if it was shorter, we would issue her a refund, I finished wearily. I thought, damn the woman anyway. And then I laughed. She had guts, one couldn't deny that, all kinds of guts. Mrs. Davidson allowed herself a smile. And if I am ever tempted, now that I am in my dotage, to believe I know all there is to know about one of my fellow creatures, I try to remember that smile. Before that day, I would have staked my life that I would never see Mrs. Davidson, one of the most proper women I have ever known, smile fondly as she thought about a girl who was pregnant out of wedlock. Guts, I don't know, Doctor, but she knows her own mind, that one. She certainly does. A month passed, and Miss Stansfield showed up promptly for her appointment, simply appearing out of that wide, amazing flow of humanity that was New York then and is New York now. She wore a fresh-looking blue dress to which she managed to communicate a feeling of originality, of one-of-a-kindness, despite the fact that it had been quite obviously picked from a rack of dozens just like it. Her pumps did not match it. They were the same brown ones in which I had seen her last time. I checked her over carefully and found her normal in every way. I told her so, and she was pleased. I found the prenatal vitamins, Dr. McCarran. Did you? That's good. Her eyes sparked impishly. The druggist advised me against them. God save me from pestle pounders, I said, and she giggled against the heel of her palm. It was a childlike gesture, winning in its unself-consciousness. I never met a druggist that wasn't a frustrated doctor, and a Republican. Prenatal vitamins are new, so they're regarded with suspicion. Did you take his advice? No, I took yours. You're my doctor. Thank you. Not at all. She looked at me straightforwardly, not giggling now. Dr. McCarran, when will I begin to show? Not until August, I should guess. September, if you choose garments which are voluminous. Thank you. She picked up her purse, but did not rise immediately to go. I thought that she wanted to talk and didn't know where or how to begin. You're a working woman, I take it. She nodded. Yes, I work. Might I ask where? If you'd rather I didn't. She laughed, a brittle, humorless laugh, as different from a giggle as day is from dark. In a department store. Where else does an unmarried woman work in the city? I sell perfume to fat ladies who rinse their hair and then have it done up in tiny finger waves. How long will you continue? Until my delicate condition is noticed. I suppose then I'll be asked to leave, lest I upset any of the fat ladies. The shock of being waited on by a pregnant woman with no wedding band might cause their hair to straighten. Quite suddenly her eyes were bright with tears. Her lips began to tremble, and I groped for a handkerchief, but the tears didn't fall, not so much as a single one. Her eyes brimmed for a moment, and then she blinked them back. Her lips tightened and then smoothed out. She simply decided she was not going to lose control of her emotions, and she did not. It was a remarkable thing to watch.
End of side 2.